Hello there and welcome to the A to D talk show, where we talk about controversial issues and deliberate on them. We believe that the world is like a coin and it is best to see both sides of it. So come on, join us as we agree to disagree.
Good day, everyone, those who are live and those who are listening to us via the podcast. Welcome to another episode on the African Forum A to D Agree to Disagree talk show. Today, we are going to be talking about democracy in Africa. This topic speaks for itself. Democracy in Africa, the failed experiment with a question mark. So this topic is posed as a question. And we have gone through two topics. We have gone through Africa's history, the lesson for the future. We have gone through who to blame, current leaders or colonial masters. We have gone through all these esoteric and very important topics. And today we are going to be talking about democracy. We're going to talk about Africa. And I have a very good friend of mine here. His name is Ndu Uzor. I'm sure I didn't pronounce that well, but I know you forgive me. So I welcome him. He's going to bring a very esoteric knowledge to this talk show. I spoke to him during the week, and we have a lot we want to tell you. So, Ndu Uzor, thank you very much for coming to A2D. Thank you for accepting my invitation. Thank you for being here. Now, democracy in Africa. Just to, you know, lay down the rules. Democracy, or to lay down the rules, democracy is a form of government in which the common people hold a political power. Well, that is what it is. And now, the history of democracy goes as far back as 530 BC in Greece, the Greek philosophers. And we have quite a good number of countries that have democratic processes in the Western world, in Europe, in Asia, and also in Africa. And in Africa, I think the country with the longest, with the oldest democratic process is Botswana. And we have other countries like Nigeria, South Africa, Kenya, Uganda, that have, in quote, democratic processes. So, Ndu, my question to you is, basically the topic, which is, has democracy in Africa, is it a failed experiment? Has it succeeded or has it failed?
Thank you so much for having me on the show, Kelechi. Yes, you did butcher my name. It's actually Mbozo. And just a short introduction. I'm essentially an economist by training and a private sector development specialist by profession. This was quite an interesting topic when you raised it, that we'd sit down and discuss these issues that Africa faces, but in a much more critical and insightful way. And I'm hoping that today we will have a lot of engagement so that we get to the crux of what is the actual issue. But to answer your question, I think when people say, has democracy failed, we need to kind of first set the ground rules of what we mean. And obviously there's a lot of debate around what would you term a democracy, but what elements we can pull out that are general and consistent across Western culture and African culture and probably some parts of the Middle East is I summarize it into four key elements. So the one would be a country where you have free and fair elections, and then you have active participation of the people or of civil society. The third would be a protection of human rights. And the fourth would be the rule of law. So you need to also have institutions that can hold the government accountable and ensure that human rights are protected and that the laws of the country are adhered to. So when people say democracy has failed, I think the framing of that question is somewhat misleading in the sense that I think when people talk about democracy failing, they're talking about economic structures failing.
Okay.
So they're not necessarily talking about... Are you able to hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Yeah, so I don't think people are talking about the fundamentals of democracy failing. I think they're talking about their lived experiences don't necessarily support what the fundamentals of democracy are aiming to achieve. And a big factor here is one of using political power to increase economic prosperity for everyone in that specific country. And what we're experiencing at the moment is that we have representation, but the outcomes of what we had expected are subpar, with things like corruption, people still living in poverty. There's a lot of violence across the African nation. And so people look at these things and they say, democracy has failed. But I think for Africa in general, we're in the process of democratizing Africa.
I agree with you.
There were a lot of systems and fundamentals that were not in place after independence. One of those things would be strong institutions that are meant to govern and are essentially meant to bring about the outcomes that we as a society would have intended. So my short answer after that long rant is, I don't think it's failed. I don't think we can alike and agree that it does intend for good outcomes. It's just all the different systems that are supposed to ensure these outcomes have not been in place, and sometimes have been abused and not necessarily run as efficiently as they could have.
Okay. I picked from what you said is the way you categorized democracy or democratic processes based on free and fair election, human rights, rule of law. Now, when we look back at the intent of democracy, which is power to the people, for the people, by the people. So these people are supposed to be the one who create these laws. But when you look at how in Africa today, like for example, in Uganda, how during elections, first, no one has confidence in the elections in Uganda, especially in many African countries. It's that they think it's been rigged, or it's actually been rigged, or the boat, right? And people also face, people are being antagonized. For example, again in Uganda, a man has been in office for over 31 years, and a new young juvenile person comes out and says, okay, we want to take power. And you see he's been persecuted. So in the categories you gave for democracy in a country, do you think that the fundamental issues of our democratic processes are based off on an election? Now, the reason I'm asking this question is you said something about the economic outcome, right? Now, the economic outcome most of the time is based on policies, and these policies are being made by people who are already in power. Now, what I'm saying, for example, in China, we have in China where there is pure communism. There is no, in the democratic index, they are quite low. But we both can agree that China is doing well economically, right? We can say, which other country now? Maybe, the UK has a democratic process. But the point I'm trying to say is this. The point I'm trying to make is this. Democracy in America started in 1776 during the time of independence. Democracy has helped the country. Democracy has sustained the country. Americans have confidence in their election. But here in Africa, people do not believe in their elections. People who want to run for office can't even run for office. And even if they dare to try, their human rights have been violated. And maybe what we may have, maybe just the rule of law, in which there is no institution, like you said, to enforce those things. So do you think that the fundamental issues, don't you think that the fundamental issues of our democratic, the democratic fiasco is based off of these elections being rigged and people not having confidence in them?
I mean, I think elections are part of the conversation, but I don't think they. So, I'm going to take us a couple of steps back. So, if you're talking about African elections being rigged, we need to kind of look at the incentive for rigging elections, right? And what we can, I think, agree on is that there's clearly in most African countries an incentive to hold and concentrate power amongst a specific elite. And I mean, you guys had a conversation around colonialism in the last podcast, and I mean, we won't really get into that, but what we can see is that they... there are kind of, I'd say, three historical moments happening now. During the time of where most African countries were asking for or were fighting for independence, what you saw is an emergence of authoritarian kind of states where you have single party states where majority of the people look at that political party as their single states were able to concentrate power, not necessarily just politically, but also economically, right? I mean, we take Nigeria, your country, where you have very rich oil reserves, but there's a lot of corruption that goes around the control of those reserves. There's a lot of corruption that goes around controlling key organs of state where self-interest takes the forefront. True. Greed takes the forefront. True. And another thing which you link with that is that underlying all of this is just the capitalist. And so when you want to think about why someone has the interest of rigging an election, of sending out the military to essentially concentrate that power, you have to think about what is their personal interest, because there's mortgages attached to these things. There's a lifestyle attached to these things. The president, and I'm not going to point out any country, but let's assume a corrupt president. He's already set up some sort of network where his life and him maintaining the lifestyle that he lives, even his ministers, is dependent on them holding power. And so they will rig elections, like what we saw in Uganda, where an authoritarian leader who did well for Uganda brought stability. But at the point where young people are saying, we still feel as if we haven't received the economic gains of the stability of this leadership and we want change, him getting out of power has material benefit or has material consequences to him, but also the network of people that he is essentially working with. So I don't think political or the right to vote is the isolated issue. You do need these organs of state that will hold these leaders accountable. You do need an active civil society. And by active civil society, if you look at the countries where democracy has worked, you have a growing middle class, an educated middle class that is active in the political landscape because it has a material consequence on their livelihoods. Another thing just to mention is you also see in countries where there's a small private sector, not a lot of political engagement. So I'll break it down in this way. In the West, the government plays a role of facilitating economic activity. In Africa, if you look at the structure of the economies, the government plays a role of driving the economy. It's mostly government-induced economic spending in those countries. And so, which points to the fact that the government itself controls a lot of economic power. And if they control a lot of economic power, they also have a lot of incentive to abuse that power, to rig elections, switch off social media networks, and the likes, like what we've seen in Uganda.
Yeah. So you just said something, and I just want to.
I don't know if that answers your question holistically.
Yes, it does. It does. It does. Because what you're saying is the rigging of election isn't the fundamental issue. It is a result of a fundamental issue. So it's that's
yes.
Is a result. It is not the main problem. There is a domino effect. There is a ripple effect, and it is the resulting factor of such issues. Such like the fundamental issue you just spoke about is having economic the government having control of the economic power. So with such kind of power the government has, they begin to create incentives, and then they're able to now create institutions around them that can enable them to hold on to political power. Yeah, so your answer was very, very, was your answer, your answer gave a different perspective to my question. And then I want to now ask you another question that, I mean, it's, you said something about active civil society and how in the Western world that plays a very important role. So in Africa here today, how do you think we can encourage, whether as individuals or as a community or as government, to how can we encourage active civil society?
So it goes back to what I was talking about when I said, when you have a country where there's a material stake, the politics of that country, right? Where if your government, for example, does not create a business environment where you as an individual in a capitalist economic system can flourish, you have a material stake in that. You have, I think there's a book called Skin in the Game. You have skin in the game. Yeah. And so the civil society itself will essentially rise up and want to make a contribution to how that country is run. In a country where the education system is not that great, where there's a lot of information asymmetry, for example, maybe people are not connected to social media, they don't really have the ability to understand the governance structure of their country or to understand the actual policies that... Are you able to hear me?
I'm hearing you. I can hear you.
You're frozen on my end.
I can hear you.
Okay. So I was saying that... All right. I was saying that in a country where the education system is not... I really have the ability to engage critically in the politics of that country, you will find that civil society is not as engaged in their politics, and governments are able to get away with a lot of things that are done in secret, are able to get away with a lot of decision-making that is not necessarily representative. It's a multifaceted issue. I don't think there's one button we can press right now to solve that issue. I don't think there's one button we can press right now to solve that issue because it requires a robust education system. It requires protection of human rights. We shouldn't be seeing things like what happened in Uganda during the election, where the social media platforms and the internet is shut down, because that essentially limits the ability of civil society to engage. But also, you also need civil society organizations that are not necessarily entrenched in the government, but are private, because then they're able to hold the government accountable without necessarily having any, there won't necessarily be any fallback. I'll give you one quick example of what I mean by this. In South Africa, for example, you have a national prosecuting authority that is appointed by the head of the National Prosecuting Authority. It's all going to gather and say that we are going to fight against whatever issue. Yeah. If the heads of those critical organs of state have an invested role in the government, or at least are somewhat have interest in maintaining the government's control, then the role of civil society becomes limited because the institutions you've set up are not able to hold the people you're trying to hold accountable. So there are two elements to it. One is education and information and an active engagement of civil society. But two, the institutions that are in place need to recognize the role that civil society plays, because people become disenfranchised when they want to say something, but it doesn't necessarily go anywhere. You can protest, the organs of state have an interest in maintaining specific power.
Thank you. I mean, that was very
okay. So I'll end it there.
Yeah, that was that. I mean, you have said so many things, because when I invited you and when I thought about this topic in the first instance, I didn't think about it from the concept of economic stability and active civil society. I was thinking about it as from a perspective of, okay, so we have people who do not, again, I've said this already, but you are brought in a new perspective, and I think it's very provoking, because it makes me think in a different light now as regards to democracy in Africa, whether it has worked or not. So if anyone on the audience, if you have anything to say, if you have any questions to ask, you're free to. Now, we have talked about the problem. We have talked about the issues. Where do we go from here as a continent? Where do we go? How do we even start creating this country of, can you hear me? Just see if you can hear me. Where do we go from here? We have talked about the problem. We know the problem. I know you have said a little about economic development, economic stability. Now, the truth is this. It is not going to be easy to take back power from people who do know who. It's not easy to take power from someone who has power, because he can use the power to ensure you don't collect power from him. Right? So the question I want you to answer is, someone is asking a question. He's saying, your point of view of the Zondo Commission and the finding in the state capture. I don't know if this is a question for you. Can you see the question from your own end?
Yeah, I can.
Do you want to answer that quickly before we continue? Or do you understand the question?
I mean, I do understand the question, and I think a system or some process that has been put in place, and this is specifically speaking to South Africa, which is a process of accountability. So that's just context for anyone who's not South African. So the Zondo Commission essentially is part of the process of ridding the South African government of corrupt acts. There's a term which we use, which is state capture, which is essentially the whole government of South Africa is captured by external influence. And essentially this has an impact on economic development and outcomes in South Africa. So what I think about the Zondo Commission itself, I think it's a very important commission. I think it shows what the institutions, how it shows that if you have strong institutions in place that are essentially acting to hold the leaders accountable, you might be able to encourage better behavior or incentivize better behavior within that specific state. To what extent that commission is going to be effective, sometimes we have these commissions and people are ousted, but there's no actual repercussions for their actions. So I can only answer to what I have seen right now. I've seen that the commission is a place where a lot has been revealed, where corruption and the different links that it has had in the country have been exposed, which has really brought about quite extensive reality check for a lot of South Africans, that we have this liberation movement, but this liberation movement has been in power for over 25 years, but essentially has concentrated power, and there's been a lot of corrupt activity within that specific party. But the overall commission's intent is good, and I actually support it.
Okay, thank you, Unduzo. He's asking another question. I think this question is for me. He said, last year we saw a lot of police brutality in Nigeria. So much injustice. Why? So there are several ways to answer this question, and I wish I can take all the different perspectives. The truth is, people did not face, there are no consequences for action. This may be a Nigeria problem, or this may be an African problem. We do not have consequences for action. We do not have rewards for action. We do not have penalties. So when someone, you are being, if you're in the United States, they will call it racial profiling, right? So that's if a white man is doing this to a black person. But now people are being profiled in such a way that if you have a tattoo on your body, if you're a young person, you have a tattoo on your body and you're doing well, you maybe have a car, maybe you have a laptop in your car, they immediately suspect that, the way you get your money is not legit. You're into cyber crime or cyber fraud. And most of the time, this is outside their line of duty. They're not supposed to be doing this. You're a police officer and you're supposed to attend to crimes based on request, you're not there to either be proactive or whatever it is. So people, for the past 6-7 years, police officers have been killing civilians without getting any repercussion. They're not being court-martialed, and no justice has been truly served. So this is why you can see the a lot of police brutalities and injustice in the country here. So, and this, again, police is an arm, is the tool, is a political tool in Nigeria here. They just use them for either to win elections or to maneuver and manipulate people or to make them scared or whatever it is. But it is a pity, and we have found ourselves here. And we hope that one day we can change it and the story is different. So, Nduzo, do you have any other thing to say? Because I want to wrap this up. My plan was to have this for 30 minutes. I'm happy we're on time because a lot of people have been having issues with, the podcast is long. We can't listen to it for so long. So better to keep it to 30 minutes. Do you have anything to say that can seal your point? Okay, hold on. Before you want to answer that, before you want to answer that, someone is asking a question. Can you perhaps give suggestions as to how neighboring African countries can help intervene in instances where dictators abuse their power, like we saw in Uganda? Also, do you think the African Union can do more to help? I have an answer to this question, but I want you to answer it, please.
So, I mean, I think, and we saw this recently with Zimbabwe, right? There was a bit of political unrest in Zimbabwe, and in South Africa specifically, people were calling for the South African government to say something and intervene. And I remember I was listening to this radio show where one of these political analysts was speaking, and what he said I found quite interesting. And it speaks to this specific question, which was, the one thing that we need to recognize is that countries are independent states, right? That have their own rules, that have their own functionings, and that is something we need to respect, right? And I think, yeah, they have their own sovereignty, and I think that is something that even the African Union, the UN, all these national, they want to maintain that and respect that, and so. There's only a certain extent to which external forces can intervene in a specific government's politics and how that specific country is run. So let's keep that in mind. Of course, it doesn't mean that the AU and the UN and all these organizations cannot do anything. I mean, we've seen historically where there are instances of human rights violations, genocide, and the likes, where these countries decide to impose specific sanctions, right? And that only is often what we see as an extreme solution. At the first thing is somewhat to get some sort of diplomatic intervention through such organizations. But to the extent to which I think the AU can do something about the situation in Uganda, I'm not too sure. I don't think that there's a lot that they can do, especially given that the elections have been said to be marred with violence, police involvement, some sort of political interference, and that they were not free and fair. right? But the extent to which organizations such as the AU, even donors, for example, which have quite a significant stake in the progress of African countries, find it difficult to essentially effect some sort of change in these countries, mainly because of what I said initially, which is the sovereignty element.
So, thank you. But just to also add, right, just to corroborate your point, I think we are in an age where political leaders, especially in Africa, and dictators find it quite hard to continue in their dictatorial processes and in their dictatorial way of controlling the country. And why I say this is, there is social media. I'm in Nigeria here, I can know what's going on in Uganda, I can know what's going on in South Africa, I can know what's going on at every single corner of the world at an instant in time. And the good thing about this is, the political power in different countries cannot longer control the way the news or the way their countries are being framed or the way their countries are being portrayed internationally. So you would see that in Uganda, if we were in a century where there were no phones, there were no internet, it's going to be hard for you to know what's going on in Uganda. It's very hard for even the neighboring country to know what's happening in Uganda. But now we're in an age of information. So one of the biggest threat to dictators is exposure. That is why one of the first steps they do is to censor, to block out internet. That's what you see the same thing in North Korea. You see the same thing in King Leopold II and what he did to DR Congo. So when he had DR Congo as a private asset, and when the US started having investigations and the UN started having investigations on him as regards to what he was doing in DR Congo, the first thing he did was to burn down books, to burn down all the records. You see the same pattern with Hitler. So one of the things that blows their mind, one of the things they can't somehow grasp, is the ideology of exposure. So that is just what we can keep doing, is to keep retweeting, keep exposing them in whatever way you can. And hopefully, at a point, one day we'll win. Now, there is a second question that says, do you think the level of participation from young people in the space of politics and economy is at a satisfactory level? If not, what can be done to change this? I think I want to answer this question because we did a topic on this. We talked about this in my former part in the previous episodes, but this was not for the African Forum. If you can go and check it, go to Apple Store, Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and type in A2D Talk Show. You see all my episodes. We have talked about some of these things. But just to give you a quick answer to your question about young people, the truth is this. The young ones we have been scared. You try and oppose these old oligarchies, they come after you. They come after you in the strangest and the most nefarious way you can ever imagine. So when they do this to one person, they send a message to every single person. You see what went down in Uganda? You're a musician who turned to be a politician, tried to oppose an existing government who has been there for years. See what they did to him. See what they did to his family. So that is a message to people. Now, how can we solve this problem? How we can solve this problem is the young people, and this is why this show exists, the way you can organize people, the way you can mobilize the young people of every demographics, every country at all, is to empower them with knowledge. The moment the young people of every country have a very decent historical knowledge of their country, have a very good historical knowledge of other countries and how they have operated, then they are able to approach politics from a more logical manner, not from a sentimental or emotional standpoint. That's the first way. The second way is people. We need to start speaking one thing. We need to start saying one thing at a time. We need to come up with one voice, because one of the things we have found in Nigeria today, and this is sad. Young people should join politics. The young people that are in politics are not even doing well. They are now even tools. They are tools for the old political leaders. So again, it doesn't make, I don't want you to be in politics, or I don't want you to be my president, or to have to run for a public office because you're young. I want you to run because you have political understanding. So, Nduzo, if you have anything to say as regards to this question, so we have one last question and then we wrap it up.
I think I have somewhat closing remarks that might... agree is that the intentions of democracy are good. What underlines it is you and I as individuals to have an active role in how our country is governed, and we want the outcomes of that political power to be economic prosperity. I want to live in a country where my rights are protected. I want to live in a country where I'm able to make a good living for myself and my family, right? And what we are seeing now is a growing social tension where the one part of the system is working, but the other is not. And your question around where do I see all of this going and now brings in, but also we need to understand what is currently happening at the moment. The trend is a shift in colonialism, one state parties, to multi-party states. And what we are seeing now is disenfranchised youth who have access to information, mm-hmm. who are no longer willing to be silenced, mm-hmm. Who want their governments to create a space where that fosters innovation, a space that allows them to essentially make something of their lives. And mm-hmm. what they are seeing is that they are not represented in the current single party politics, where you have old men and women deciding your future and deciding the trajectory of your country. Do I think that youth involvement has been satisfactory? I don't think it's been satisfactory. I think it's definitely on an upward trend, but there's clearly a lot more engagement from youth. I mean, what we saw happen in Nigeria, that was predominantly a youth-led movement. What we saw happen in South Africa, that was predominantly a youth-led movement. In Uganda, a youth-led movement. So what I kind of predict to happen, and it's probably going to go up and down, is somewhat something we saw around 2011, 2012, during the Arab Spring. It's going to happen in a lot of African nations. And what we've seen is glimpses of young people saying that they have had enough. And obviously the governments, the incumbent governments still want to maintain power. And so they will use some sort of force and violence through their military power or the police. But all these things create some sort of cycle, and that cycle bubbles up to a revolution. And you will see it in certain countries going forward where democracy becomes even more entrenched. And in some countries, you'll see it take a couple of steps back. But for the general African nation, the trajectory is upwards, and I don't think that it's a failed experiment. I think it's an idea that holds a lot of promise. And the more we engage as young people, and the more we push and we make our voices heard, the more we are likely to see change. I mean, you and I can agree. I don't think the next election for Uganda will look like what it looked now. Because young people have realized that there is a possibility to have multi-party politics in Uganda, and there is a possibility for a young person who's 35 years old to run for political office. True. And we were more likely to see the similar things happening in Nigeria, similar things happening in Ghana, similar things happening in South Africa. And we shouldn't lose hope. I definitely think there is a positive trajectory for democracy in Africa generally.
Okay, thank you very much, Nduzo. Thank you very much. That was very spot on. So one last question here is saying, since SA that South Africa and Nigeria are two countries with a higher GDP in Africa, which of these two countries would you guys choose to reside in currently? So my question is, I don't know. I haven't been to South Africa before, and so I cannot compare. But I am doing well in Nigeria. And the country or the place is greener where you water it, right? So that's my answer to that. I don't know if you want to answer that question, but I want us to wrap this up in a minute. Do you want to answer that? Do you want to answer that?
I think you've summed it up perfectly. I think it's quite a subjective thing. I've never been to Nigeria. I think it's a beautiful country. I'm quite excited about its economic trajectory. There are a lot of interesting things that I think are going to happen over the next couple of years, specifically linked to your oil sector. But I can't answer that.
So thank you all very much for asking this question. I see a lot of South Africans here asking the question. I appreciate all of you. I appreciate you for inviting them. Thank you so much. I appreciate you, Ndoza. I appreciate you. Thank you for making our time. Thank you all for coming. Please do not forget to subscribe to my podcast. This recording should be out on Tuesday or Wednesday. A to D Talk Show, anywhere. You can drop your email. I'll send the link, the podcast link to you. So please share with all of them. Thank you, Ndoza, once again for making our time to be here. I appreciate you. And thank you all that are here and those who are listening on the podcast. Thank you for listening. And next week, we are talking about tribalism and religion, the Trojan horse. So it's going to be very interesting, very, very interesting. Please make our time to come and make our time to be here. Thank you, Ndoza. Thank you all. And have a wonderful day and have a wonderful week. Bye.
Thanks, Kelechi. Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.